You're listening to the Illuminaire podcast, where we dive deep into behavioral health topics and shine a bright light on the forces shaping this industry's future, from research and technology to business and investment and more. Here's your host, Dr. Ronit Molko.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Ronit Molko, and thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Illuminaire podcast. Today, we are talking about children and adolescents and mental health. I am thrilled to welcome my guest, Dr. Anjani Amladi, to the Illuminaire podcast. Dr. Amladi is a double board-certified adult psychiatrist and child-adolescent psychiatrist focusing on an integrative approach to patient care. Dr. Amladi has an extensive background in treating a wide variety of psychiatric disorders such as ADHD, OCD, bipolar disorder, depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, and eating disorders. She's the author of the Amazon best-selling children's picture book, When the World Got Sick, which helps children and caregivers talk about the impact of COVID-19 and how to navigate the stressful time. Dr. Amladi, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited to have this conversation because, you know, as we're starting to reopen here in the United States, there are many countries that are far behind us in terms of getting the vaccine and being able to start to reopen. And so I think as we start to reopen and return to some kind of normalcy here, we're starting to take stock of the impact that COVID has had over the last 18 months, both some positive things, some silver linings that have come out of it, but also a lot of negative impact and negative consequences as a result of what we've just seen globally. And, you know, some of the positive things that people are talking about are things like much more flexibility in work mm-hmm. hours, work schedule, you know, learning how to be productive from home, businesses and corporations figuring out or finding out for the first time that you don't really have to have these big office spaces because people can work quite efficiently from home and do well, and that improves work-life balance. And then, of course, the great advances that we've seen in telehealth and telemedicine that we're now able to reach people that we couldn't reach before. But then, of course, on the flip side, we have some of the negative effects, which many, many families are mourning losses and people that they've mm-hmm. lost from COVID and other diseases during this time. And then, of course, one of the greatest impacts we're seeing is this big rise in mental health. So right. What are you seeing in your practice in terms of the rise in mental health over the last year, 18 months?
Oh, I think it's been quite significant. So, I mean, towards the beginning of the pandemic, most of my practice is seeing children. I'm a double boarded psychiatrist for adults and for children and adolescents. So the vast majority of my practice is children and families. So I would say towards the beginning, the first few weeks or the first few months of the pandemic, when maybe there was an expectation that it might be over fairly quickly, that I didn't see that much of an increase. And then as soon as we kind of became aware that this is something that's going to be going on for much, much longer, that's when the spike of influx of patients that I saw clinically. And that's kind of steadily risen over the last year. My schedule is booked out usually at least a month, month and a half in advance. And I think a lot of my colleagues are seeing the same as well.
And what are you seeing mostly? Is it increases in depression, anxiety? What specifically are you seeing in kids? And when you say children and adolescents, what age do you generally treat?
So 17 and under is what my subspecialty is in, but I also see adolescents and young adults as well. So the vast majority of my practice, I would say, is 17 and under, but I do see quite a bit of 18 to 25. So that's fairly common for me to see both adults and children, but the vast majority is children. And I would say that the most common thing that I saw in practice even before the pandemic was anxiety, but the primary complaint for both kids and families as the pandemic has kind of exacerbated over the last year, it's primarily anxiety that I see still.
So one of the things that we're talking a lot about in the media certainly is kind of the long-term impact, right? We don't really know yet what the impact of COVID over this 12 to 18 month period is going to have 5 years from now. So right. Some of the things I think about, two of the groups that I really think about are kids who started kindergarten in COVID, you know, last year, and so couldn't go to school. And, you know, you're starting this big, what is supposed to be this big experience in your life and this big kind of transition into, you know, big school. And, you know, kids were at home. And of course, then all the complexities of trying to teach really young kids virtually and using technology. Sure. And then the other group would be the, you know, seniors graduating high school that missed out on all those kind of real milestone events that you have, as mm-hmm. well as students starting their first year of college. So are you seeing things exacerbated in those age groups and those specific markers in life?
Yes, I would say that the younger kiddos that I see in the office are generally less phased, I think, because especially for kids who are just starting grade school, like kindergarten, for example, they don't really have anything to compare it to unless they were in preschool before. But my older kids, you know, my kiddos that are missing eighth grade promotion, for example, or my seniors in high school that are missing prom or homecoming or having a traditional graduation and starting their first year of college, not knowing if it's going to be remote or in person. The older kids are the ones that seem to be having a much more difficult time because they've seen either older friends or older siblings or cousins or other family members be able to engage in these rites of passage that are really important, and kind of missing out on that has been really difficult for them.
And how do you think, how are you treating to, how do you suggest that parents talk to kids and help manage, you know, these marker events that students are missing out on?
I think it's really important to not minimize the experience. I think some of my kids that struggle the most are when they feel like their concerns are not validated, that, oh, it's just an eighth grade graduation or it's just a high school graduation. But for them, they've been looking forward to this experience for years. And it's not a choice that has been taken away from them. It's just a product of circumstance. So I think making sure that we're not minimizing the real feelings that kids are having and really validate their feelings and their concerns about having missed out on something that may not seem like a big deal to an adult, but it's a huge deal for them.
Right. Right. And, you know, one of the things I think about having teenage kids myself is, you know, typically this age group, junior, senior in high school, mm-hmm. kids are going out, they're going to parties, they're kind of learning life skills with the safety of being able to come home or the safety of having parents mm-hmm. nearby for the most part that are there to help them. One of the things I think about is, what do you think is going to happen for these kids who missed out on those 2 years or 18 months of that experience and then go off to college and haven't really mm-hmm. had the opportunity to kind of test and develop those coping skills around what it means to be 16, 17, 18 and starting to deal with things in life that, you know, that you're dealing with for the first time.
Sure. And I think that's a valid concern for a lot of parents. And, you know, having the discussion about what that's going to look like as time goes on is something that's really important. And it's not something that I think should be ignored. I think it's something that should be acknowledged that, and you're absolutely right, juniors, seniors, they're driving, they're going out with friends, they're doing things, and they have kind of a safety net of parents being close by as kind of a sounding board or just for advice or just a presence of feeling safe. And depending on where they're going to school, if they're going out of state or not somewhere close by, having those discussions ahead of time is going to be really important. And also making sure that we're being an open line of communication so that when they do have those experiences that at times can be difficult, that we're still providing support and help in a meaningful way, knowing that they kind of missed out on some of that experience because of what's been happening over a year now.
Right, right. Do you have any specific tips that you give to teens or to their parents about, you know, how to deal with, you know, for example, if you go to college and you're having social issues or you're being ostracized by the kids or you don't find your kind of your people, your group of kids to hang out with, and it's just been harder because, you know, you don't have that group that you've come out of your senior year with. Do you have any tips or advice and things to think about for these kids?
Sure. And I think social interaction, I mean, just growing up in general is something that's really important, that it takes time to find your tribe, so to speak, that, you know, if your dormitory mates or people that you're in classes with, you haven't found your quote unquote people yet, don't give up. keep trying. It's really difficult to kind of get back into a social game when we're not used to having that. We're used to being in a house with our nuclear family and not really having much interaction. And socialization is a skill. So when we're not using it, it's going to take us a little bit more time to kind of get back into the swing of things. But now that things are opening and more people are getting vaccinated and there's more opportunity to socialize, I think it's important for kids who are struggling. I'm not able to find friends yet. I'm not able to do X, Y, and Z yet. But at some point, the opportunity will present itself. And being ready to kind of take that leap when it does is going to be really, really important.
Yeah, that's a really important distinction that you make there. I've read some of the recent literature on suicide and depression, and they were saying that typically family members don't ask kids who are severely depressed, are you thinking of committing suicide? Mm-hmm. Are you thinking of hurting yourself? Because they're scared to put the idea in a child's mind. But what I read in this research article was that you should actually be asking that question, because kids, once you name it, once you approach a child with it and you have that conversation, A, you can assess risk, but B, it almost provides a sense of relief for the child because it creates a conversation around it. What's your viewpoint on that?
100%. By asking the question, if the thoughts are already there, there is no evidence that asking the question puts that idea into kids' heads. The danger of not asking that question, especially if as a parent or a care provider, that there are things that you are observing that are concerning, by not asking the question and not being curious about what might be happening with someone that you care about, increases the risk of their struggles going unnoticed and thus being untreated. And I think making sure that we are having those discussions with our kids and putting words to something that they may be struggling with, it opens the door for conversation, which especially, you know, my teens in particular want to engage in, but sometimes they don't know how. They don't know how that subject is going to be received. Mm-hmm. They don't know what to say. They may not even know what it's called. But if somebody that they care about is taking the initiative to approach them about something that they may be wanting to talk about and don't know where to start, is a huge thing. And that's definitely something that I see clinically as well, that kiddos, even recently over the last few weeks or so, the sense of relief that someone has asked them is huge. So I've seen quite a few teens, 15, 16, 17, who said, you know, I feel like I've been going downhill and all of these things are happening, but I didn't know how to bring it up because I don't know what my parents would say. Mm-hmm. So when my mom or my dad or whoever is the primary caregiver asked me, I felt such a huge sense of relief because now they know, and now I can get the help that I need. And it's really powerful to have a kid say something like that to you when in reality that could have gone on for several months or several years and have gone unnoticed.
Right. And what should a parent do? I mean, you know, if you ask your child that question and they say, yes, I am thinking of harming myself. I mean, what are some of the first things parents can do? In my experience, child psychiatrists are so busy that often, you know, I've had friends and I've made calls and it's like, well, you know, I can see you in 6 weeks, or as you said, right, you're booked up. And so mm-hmm. What can a parent do that day to kind of help that child, you know, provide some support if professionals are not immediately accessible?
Sure. So the first conversation that I always have with parents is risk assessment, knowing what to look for. If kids are having suicidal thoughts, but they're not, there's no intent or no plan behind it, then the risk itself is fairly low. So one of the things that we always want to ask is, okay, if you're having thoughts of wanting to harm yourself, is that something that you've done before? Because when we talk about risk assessment, past behavior, self-injurious behavior, or suicide attempt is a much larger risk factor when we talk about future self-injurious behavior. So risk assessment is very, very important when we have this discussion. So when we talk about safety, the other thing that we talk about always when I see kiddos that come into my office, it's access. So limiting access to things like over-the-counter medications or other types of medicines that might be just easily available. Because the vast majority of kids who do something to harm themselves, it's because they had access and were feeling fairly impulsive in the moment. The vast majority of kids that I see, and I've worked in many, 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 many different areas in mental health, when you see kids who are acutely in crisis, who have done something to hurt themselves, and then they end up in the emergency department, they are quite often very, very remorseful and regret the decision that they made in the moment because they were feeling very impulsive. And that is why limiting access is something that's really important, making sure that if there are firearms in a home, that they're locked. If there are medications that are available, that they're locked. That if, you know, a kiddo is saying, you know, I'm having these types of thoughts and this is how I might do it, then limiting access to those items is really important. And as far as getting treatment goes, if there's ever an acute concern about safety, the emergency department or any type of mental health crisis unit is the first place that I would go. So a lot of times parents say they feel helpless because they don't really know how to get in touch with a psychiatrist or a child psychiatrist because they're booked out several weeks or several months. The emergency department or any type of mental health crisis center is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So there is someone available if there's something that's going on and you don't know what to do. There's also the National Suicide Hotline, which is open 24/7 as well, that you can call if you are in acute crisis or need assistance. If we're talking about acuity and the acuity is maybe lower, that maybe there's some depression or some anxiety and maybe some suicidal thoughts, but no intent or plan, kids usually have a really good relationship with their pediatrician or whoever is functioning as their primary care doctor. And even checking in with their regular provider, maybe once a week or once every 2 weeks, until they're able to establish with a different mental health provider, feeling supported and feeling heard and feeling cared about and being monitored is one of the really, really helpful evidence-based ways we can connect people to treatment without necessarily a therapist or a psychiatrist.
Right. Okay. That's all very helpful. You read stories where parents say, I had no idea. I saw no signs. Mm-hmm. And then a child ended up taking their life. If a parent's not seeing signs and not, obviously they're not having that conversation, what are the signs that we're missing that maybe we're just not thinking about?
Sure. And for teens, it's depression in particular is a little bit more subtle. So the soft signs that we look for kids who are depressed is their difficulty with regard to social or academic functioning. So let's say they're really good students and they're really outgoing and social, but now their grades are slipping and they're not showering regularly and they're not eating regularly and they're being more isolative and they're not interested in activities that they previously enjoyed, that they are declining family invites to do things like game night or have dinner together than when they would usually engage in those types of activities. Giving away possessions, irritability is a really good indicator of how a kid is doing mood-wise. And in younger populations, so in young adults or adolescents and kids, one of the main signs of depression is really intense irritability in the sense that you feel like any little thing could just set them off and you're almost feeling like you're walking on eggshells. That's a really good sign to kind of ask, hey, what's going on? Because I'm noticing this and can we have a conversation because I'm concerned.
And what are signs in younger kids, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, maybe some signs, but also, I mean, that's the first part of the question. The second part of the question is what kind of conversation can you be having at that age to kind of help kids know that they can come talk to you about this, that you're open to this conversation or kind of introduce the idea to them so that they know they have a place to go?
Sure. That's a great question. So for younger kids, what we look more at is because they're a little bit less verbal and a little bit less able to abstract than say older kids, what we pay attention to is more behavior. So regression specifically. So if a kiddo, let's just say, is potty trained and is normally able to do things, you know, like brush their teeth and take the dog out or feed the dog, and they're not doing those kinds of things, and they're regressing, having accidents, not sleeping throughout the night, just being generally difficult and having more behavioral outbursts and meltdowns and tantrums, it's a sign that something's happening. It may not necessarily be depression or anxiety, but it's a sign that something's happening. And I think in those moments, really tapping into how they are feeling is going to be something that's really important. Like asking them, hey, how are you feeling today? Because I'm noticing that maybe you've been a little bit more sad lately. And if they say yes, tell me a little bit more about that. I think it's really amazing when you really have a one-on-one conversation with a child, even as young as 5, it is amazing what they will tell you when you sit down and have an individual conversation one-on-one. It's really incredible what they'll say.
Very interesting. I never thought, you know, I haven't really thought about it, that age group. It's so young, but it's, that's great that's, you know, possible and positive with kids of that age. I know that one of the things that you work on is, you talk about collaborative care and the collaborative care model. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what are the benefits of individuals seeking mental health treatment?
Yes. So one of the things that I'm very passionate about is integrated mental health. So most people, when they seek mental health treatment, are often referred out. So the idea of the collaborative mental health model is that the mental health comes to you. So for example, when you go into your primary care doctor's office or your pediatrician's office, having access to somebody who's in mental health in that facility at that time. So the idea is that when you're presenting for an ailment, whatever it is, that if your doctor screens for, let's say, depression or anxiety as an example, because those are the most common ailments that we see in mental health, especially now, that the care is there in-house as opposed to having to refer out for a wait list that could be a few weeks or a few months long.
That's great. And how do we provide access, right, to quality mental health? Because one of the things we've seen, I mean, telehealth has helped with that, but one of the things we're just hearing more and more about as the mental health conversation becomes more available and, you know, and more prominent over this last year is just access to health, because there's so many barriers. There's a barrier of cost, you know, physical limitations, logistical issues, certainly in certain parts of the country where you just cannot access good mental health care, transportation. And then, of course, there's the whole piece of stigma, people who just feel too stigmatized and don't want to identify. So how do we help with some of those limitations?
And that's a really challenging part of the landscape. The way that healthcare is structured, especially in this country, is often the more money you have and the more resources you have, the easier it is for you to get services. And that is problematic, especially for folks who may not have ways and means to be able to, for example, cash pay for a therapist or cash pay for a psychiatrist. So there is real work to be done as far as infrastructure and access. And there are real problems with barriers to be able to obtain services, which is something that I see every day. And because I work in both private practice, a group private practice, as well as community mental health. And it is a real concern. So when we talk about people who are insured and have private insurance, the most effective way of going about looking for treatment is through your insurance providers, because in-network care, as you know, is much cheaper than out-of-network care. So calling the insurance providers and trying to get help in that way is probably the fastest and most efficient way of going about it. For community mental health, at least in California, so I primarily work with the Medi-Cal population, so the structure is a little bit different there. So for people who don't have insurance and maybe low income, there is often a state-run insurance entity, I guess would be a good word for it, that if you are able to get that type of state insurance, that there are services that are specifically allocated within that insurance. So for example, in California, where I practice, it's Medi-Cal. And anybody who has Medi-Cal has access to a specific list of services, mental health and physical health included.
I just want to go back because I forgot to ask you earlier, and I'll edit this in. Back to your book about COVID. So you wrote this children's book about how to talk to your kids about the pandemic. Can you tell us a little bit about the book and the approach to talk to really young kids about what's happening and what happened?
Sure. So initially, the book came about because I had a lot of parents and lots of parents and younger children coming in for resources on how do we even talk to them about what is happening right now. And in looking for resources that are age appropriate for younger kids, I wasn't finding anything. And so I figured if I can't find anything that I'm looking for, then I might as well create it myself. And that's how the book ended up coming about. And it talks about, you know, how we have this discussion about difficult things and how we acknowledge what our kiddos are seeing and some ways and strategies to try to manage this unprecedented time that we've had through the eyes of a child. And I thought, what better way to be able to open the door to that discussion than, one, a story, and two, a story with pictures, and three, a story with pictures where kids can kind of see themselves within the family unit in this book. Because it often feels like for parents that especially they feel very isolated and they're not talking to other families. So that collaboration that we used to have pre-pandemic is not there. So you feel very isolated and very alone. And think about what that feels like through the eyes of a child who aren't seeing their friends or aren't seeing their family members. So to have all of the entities that this is affecting in one story, in one book, was the way that I kind of conceptualized being able to have this discussion, have it be therapeutic, not just for the child, but for the adults in their lives as well.
Right, and provide the basis and the language, right, for the conversation.
Yeah.
Really exactly. Important. You know, I've spent most of my career working with children with autism. How has this been different, you know, for individuals with autism that you've seen? You know, certainly from the side that I've been working on, you know, we just know that change is really difficult, right? And structure is really important to autistic individuals and having predictability around schedule. And so that was definitely a big disruptor, was losing, you know, their daily schedule. And certainly a lot of individuals I know just lost access to support, much, much needed support, because people couldn't come into their homes, or they couldn't have their transportation, they couldn't have their daily activities, you know, everywhere from really young kids getting early intervention at home to adults who rely on, assisted transportation and services, support services and adult programs. So what have you seen in your practice specific to autism, and how have you helped address that?
Sure. And I think what you said is spot on. So a lot of my kiddos that were receiving special education services when schools closed, there definitely was not a liaison between schools closing and those services. So there's so many kiddos that I had, not just on the autism spectrum, but all my special education kiddos really lost a lot of the momentum that they were gaining when they had these support services in place. So when schools closed and the services didn't transfer, that was really difficult, not only for the kiddo, but for the families as well, because the vast majority of my kiddos with special needs, their parents work because they need the insurance that comes with their job to be able to pay for things like ABA or medical appointments or medication and things like that. So the burden of care, not just for education, but also just childcare in general, fell on parents, which was really difficult, not only for the kiddo, but for the parents as well. So that was really sad. And then when schools were trying to figure out how to kind of implement services, services went remote. So a lot of my kiddos were trying to, and families were trying to get services remotely, which for some of the kids that I have, worked okay. But for a lot of kids, especially kiddos with not just autism, but ADHD or anxiety as well, the idea of doing video services in theory sounds wonderful, but if you can't sit in front of a computer and don't have supervision because your parents are at work, how are you supposed to engage in those services? So that's also something that was really sad that I've been seeing. The good news is at least now with folks getting vaccinated and things opening a little bit more, some of the services are coming back up. So some of my kiddos are back in school a couple of days a week for a few hours a day, which isn't much, but it's better than nothing. And then the even better news is that next year, because most of my kiddos are out for the summer now, but next year, next academic year, everything will be back in person, which I'm really hoping helps, because even with that small amount of in-person learning in a few hours a day, a few days a week, doesn't sound like much, but for these kiddos in particular, it's huge.
And what suggestions do you have for parents to help kids readjust to that new schedule, to going back out into the world, maybe, you know, to interacting and socializing and engaging in all those activities, because it's been a big adjustment to be home and now it's almost a relearning to go out and do that.
Right. And I think especially during the summer, because there's a little bit more flexibility with kids' schedules, is practicing that. So especially for kiddos that are on the spectrum, like if they're going to a new school next year, or even their old school, is practicing, you know, driving to school in the morning and packing a lunch and walking up to the school grounds to kind of get into the habit of seeing, you know, their old school for the first time or a new school for the first time. And kind of, especially, I mean, maybe it might be a little bit too early now because now is the start of summer, but at least a few weeks before school starts, kind of getting into the routine so that it's not so such an abrupt change that can be very dysregulating for kiddos, particularly kiddos that are on the spectrum.
I actually have a friend who did that during the pandemic. She would get her kids up, get them dressed, give them breakfast, drive them on a route, and then come back home to do school. But that was kind of her way of keeping that schedule and, you know, that importance of the ritual of driving before learning started. And she kind of created that routine in the morning so the kids would drive back home, start school, and then drive again at the end of the school day, just to kind of create the start and the ending. So I think they're creative ways to do that.
And I think that that's really important, is that there's no right or wrong way to kind of get kids into the swing of things. It depends on each individual child and your family unit and what you feel the most comfortable with. What works for one family isn't necessarily going to work for another. Right. So I think instead of kind of being afraid of, oh my gosh, how are we going to do this? As parents, you're the ones who know your family unit and your kiddos the best. And getting creative with how are we going to do this is a real opportunity to spend more time together, to hang out more, to get to know each other a little bit better, to get to have some fun with it and to be a little bit more creative than maybe you were able to before. And just because it can be a little bit scary doesn't mean that it has to be hard. So getting like that, what you just described, that example is great. I love that.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. To go back to the collaborative care model for a moment, have you seen that model put into practice in areas within either where you work or other parts of the country?
So I used to do a lot of primary care mental health more when I was in residency and fellowship because of belonging to an academic institution. So I'm sure that that model exists other places as well. My clinical experience with it was more in, like I said, in residency and fellowship. And medical school as well, now that I think about it. And those types of models are usually, in my experience, affiliated with teaching institutions because of the resources that they have to be able to put those elements into place. I've also seen it at the VA as well, that they have a primary care mental health clinic model where you get primary care and mental health under the same roof. And I'm sure that there are other organizations that do that as well. I can't think of who else would have that off the top of my head, but it's a really great system and it worked really well. And it also kind of equates physical health and mental health on the same playing field. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like sometimes when you go to, let's say, a primary care physician and there are not mental health services in place, when you refer out, every step that you take to get somebody mental health is a potential barrier and is a potential mm-hmm. possibility for them to fall through the cracks, right? You make the referral and then they wait for a phone call that never comes, or they try to call the office and make an appointment, but they're booked out a few weeks to a few months. And then it's not a good way to provide care. So when and it also sends the message that mental health care is treated differently than physical health care.
I was just about to say, it mm-hmm. sends the message that kind of your physical health is primary and your mental health is secondary. I was just thinking right. that as you were saying it.
Right. And it also, to me, when we refer out for something, it also creates this image like it's a specialty service, right? If we are referring out for things like cardiology, or if we're referring out for things like a kidney specialist, if we're referring out for things that require, you know, another step to obtain services, it changes the perceived importance mm-hmm. of that service. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a problem, because all services, I mean, our minds, our bodies are all connected, and there is no one service that's more important than another. And I think treating it in a sense that, you know, these services have different values is sending the wrong message, I think.
And that's contributed to the stigma of having mental health needs, right?
Sure.
As opposed to that being primary importance. If I think about all the pediatrician visits over 20 years, I don't know that mental health came up that much.
Right. And it's a fairly new thing. I mean, I work with a lot of really amazing physicians, but even in my experience in medical school and residency and fellowship, I've had many well-meaning, competent, intelligent, very caring physicians go, I don't want to ask these kids about whether or not they're having suicidal thoughts or if they're anxious or depressed, because I don't know what to do if they say yes.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that we have to change. And at least where in California, where I live and work and practice, that is something that I see changing quite a bit. For example, when I went for my annual physical a few months ago, there was a screening measure a very short screening measure for depression on the intake form. And I realized that as I had gone back for follow-ups and things like that, that's something that they're doing every visit. That's something that I've only seen for the first time this year.
Yeah, and we've had that, you know, that's been in autism for 30 years. I mean, 20 years ago, when we went to pediatricians as service providers and said, we want you to screen for autism, they were like, absolutely not. And the fear then was, well, there were two. One is, I don't know what to say to a parent. And the other one was, if I mention the word autism, they're going to stop vaccinating their children because of what was going on with the, you know, the MMR vaccine at that time. And so I don't want to be, you know, I believe in vaccinations and I don't want to be party to my patients not getting vaccinated and then getting ill. So pediatricians would not have the conversation. And now, you know, there's the screening that the pediatrician or the office is supposed to give the parent a 12 months right. and 18 months to see if we're seeing this. But to get that conversation going and to even just put information in the waiting room at a pediatrician's office was very challenging mm-hmm. 20 and 15 and 10 years ago, because, you know, they just didn't want to have to address that and manage
right.
that. So I think that's really important, because the mental health piece, we're having more and more conversations about it, but it's really important, of right. equal importance as other areas of health.
Right. And what I was going to say too is that I think one of the silver linings of this really terrible last year plus is that we're becoming much more aware of how current events and our environment affect physical and mental health. Mm-hmm. Because it's for the first time ever, everybody is universally affected in some way by this pandemic. And if we really think about that, when in history have we ever all been affected by anything, right? So for the first time, we are all connected by this really terrible experience. And I think there is some solidarity in that and some empathy, and it contributes to this sense of collective meaning and collective suffering. And I think, and I hope, and what I'm seeing, at least clinically, is that even people who didn't believe that mental health was a real thing, didn't believe that depression existed, didn't feel that anxiety was worth treating because everybody gets anxious, are now seeing the difference between people who are just sad and people who are clinically depressed, and what that looks like and why that's worthy of treatment and why that is a real thing. So I think seeing this change in how we talk about and how we treat people with mental health issues is one silver lining of this past year.
Yeah, and thank you for highlighting that. You said that so beautifully, and I appreciate that. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Omlotti, for taking the time, especially on a weekend, to hang out with me and have this conversation. I think it's really important, you know, especially as you just highlighted the importance of mental health, but also the importance of having conversations with our kids and letting them know that they have support and that they can be heard and that they're not going through it alone and that there are people there to help them. Very, very important. Certainly, when I grew up, you know, 40, 50 years ago in South Africa, that was just not a conversation that anybody was ever having. You just didn't talk about it. It was kind of the stuff, you know, nobody wanted to talk about, and it didn't kind of exist. Right. So I think we've come a long way, and it's really great that we are where we are today.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to the Illuminaire podcast with Dr. Renit Molko. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, review, and share our show with other listeners. See you next week.